by the way. You ask them, for example, how did the 1930s depression affect you? Terribly. They look at you, you know, oops. Then what are you going to do? Well, how was the Dust Bowl era or something? And you got to really, that type of interview, some people are that way, just cryptic.
How do you convince them to open up with
you? I lead them along. That's where you got to know the territory. Let's say they live down here. I would come right back and talk about, well, how were the Dust Bowl days? I mean, the dust was even down here in Durango. We all think of it out in Oklahoma and eastern Colorado. In fact, it closed the highway right out here. It got so deep it drifted in. What do you remember about the Hooverville? There was a Hooverville in between Durango and Animas City. Animas City is the northern part of Durango. It's where the North City Market is. I might, depending on who it was, I might talk about the baseball team. It was a very good baseball team. It was a CCC camp right up here, and they might have been involved in that. I try to understand them and what they might have been doing, and once you get them to open up, I've never had anybody who was continually cryptic like that. I mean, they'll start out that way, and then if you kind of hit them with a little different question, then they'll come back, and pretty soon, some of you can't shut up. The other side of the coin is, can't shut up. Okay, me. Other side of the coin is that person who you start right here, give them a question, and they start talking, and they're back around, they're circling about five or six times, you got to get them back to topic. There was one guy in town named Art Wyatt. He was a state representative. Because he's a politician. You know, he got him going, whoopsie, he was over here, over there, everywhere around there, didn't answer the question. So you had to come back, had to bring him back. So those are the alphas and the omegas, the people who are very cryptic and the people who won't shut up. Most people fall, fortunately, somewhere in between. And once they get to know you, it becomes like just like we're talking.
I'm just going to ask a question along that line. When you know the territory and you ask them like that, it helps stimulate the memory, don't it?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. Not that you want to feed them. You don't want to lead them.
Right.
But, yeah. Oh, sure. Because, let's face it, if it happened 50 or 60 years ago, unless it was a great drama, it was a dramatic thing for them, they're going to remember aspects of it. And that's why it's so good. You know, you can talk about, well, what about Emory Smiley, who was the longtime superintendent of schools here in Smiley Junior High, is named after him. Maybe, you know, they're talking about their memory of Emory Smiley, and I might say, well, do you remember when he was principal of the high school and the big flap about the women's basketball team? Something like that. That's how you use that particular approach. And they had a real big fight to get the women's high school basketball team here, for example. He was dead set, dead in the middle of it. He was in favor of it, but he was right in the middle of it. And or you might say, well, you remember Smiley's comments or his attitude about the Klan here in Durango, and he was four square against it. So that's the type of thing, if you do know the person a little bit. And this is hard when you start at your age because you don't have it. But all these things have just sort of built up with me. Now I couldn't go to some other towns and do this because I don't know the people that well. I mean, I know the history, but Durango and San Juan's and mining and baseball, things like that, I can pretty well sit down and talk to them just one-on-one without any trouble at all.
Last year when you spoke to our class, you told us about your interviews with another colorful woman, the woman at the mine.
Oh, jeez. Good old Ms. Smith. Well, the King Coal Mine out there was outrun in the 1960s and 70s by Mr. and Mrs. Smith. And really, she just passed on here. I can't remember. Three or four or five years ago. But anyway. And they got in a real big fight with what's now known as OSHA, the government safety thing, and they just got in a real Donnybrook of a fight with him. And she became famous, and he was kind of an interesting character. She said, "Smith, here comes this little guy." His wife could have made Carl Mecklenburg look fairly small. But anyway, she became really kind of a folk hero. They made bumper stickers out of those "Here Fight at King Cole," and she could just cuss a blue streak. But she was the type of person, not a Hollywood beauty, but if you wanted to cross the plains in a covered wagon in the 1840s, she's the one you wanted. Because she was tough as nails and outdoors woman, and she chased a... one of the OSHA folks showed up, or one of the, it was a forerunner of OSHA, and she met him at the King Cole mines out here by Hesperus. It's out in Hay Gulch. And they're still mining coal. That's where the coal comes from the railroad. And she met him at the gate with a shotgun. She said, "If you set foot on this property, I'm going to blast you into eternity." And I mean, she would have done it. And to put it mildly, with this shotgun leveled right square at his chest, and Violet Smith, who was commonly called Violent, sitting behind a shotgun, and she said, "Ha, ha, ha, pardon this, he pissed in his pants," and he did. Violet thought that was pretty funny. But that was the kind of person she was. But just to show you what they'd done, they were the hardworking couple. They had a ranch out there by the King Cole Mine, and this is the type of person, woman she was. They would work all day at the ranch, and then they would go into the mines when they were opening it up. And they'd work at night in the mines. And they'd take their babies and put them in the coal cars, and put them in a side drift. And then they would work there till 10 or 11 o'clock at night, go out to the ranch. Jeez, I mean, you can't. She'd come into town here. Smith, yeah, you got to feel sorry for him. She just bossed that. I mean, she did. She ran the operation, but Smith would come into town and get drunk, and then sometimes, and Violet would come in and clean out a whole tavern. I mean, boy, and she came in and sort of like wired up, everyone dies for cover. But she was just a great interview. Next time you drive out to Hesperus, you know where Hesperus is on 160? You notice that sort of ruin over to your right there, that building? Well, that was going to be a mall. Her son, who didn't get her intelligence whatsoever, she was a very intelligent woman, put that in there for some reason and never finished it. But anyway, she stood up to the federal government, became really a cult hero. And I showed up out there one day to interview her. More than once. But the first time, I took along a person who knew her. I was going to use it for a shield. I sat down and I showed up. She says, "Young man," she said, "you're too skinny." So she fixed me dinner in the middle of the afternoon. And all the time she was talking away, boy, she was a meal and a half. It's like I grew up with no more. And then Violet Smith finally died, and Violet moved into town, and she ended up out at the Four Corners Health Care. And then she got right with God, as Billy Sunday used to say. Stopped swearing, was not as colorful, and forsook her previous career and past. And I don't know, I never interviewed her after that. But she was really a color. You don't hit those very often, that type of person. But she was just the nicest person that you ever hope to meet. I mean, as long as she liked you. And the story she had, I mean, I just gave you an idea of some of the things they did, but this is how people opened up this country. They were the Violet Smiths of the world. They weren't the Hollywood types. I mean, she just spit them in the dust, you know. And just the kindest, lovingest soul, but tough as nails and could cuss like a trooper. And, I mean, she could have plastered any one of us through that wall. And might have done it. I mean, if you offended her, she just didn't. She'd just wade right into you. Some people thought, you know, probably some men thought they should never have, should never hit a woman. But that's probably when they picked himself up off the floor. She decked them. And well, she had some classic, just classic. She was always going around to the county commissioners. I bet that must have been. This was before I got here. I didn't know about this, but she had some stories. Just, but that's the type of person that. That type of story, I mean, I knew that was going to be good because she wouldn't let people interview her. But, again, it was a friend of mine who opened up that door. And once I opened the door, boy, I was just like the dam unfolded. She just really talked and talked. And Violet Smith, yeah, she was, I've gotten some excellent interviews with women, just tremendous, interviews with women. In fact, I'm going to use three of them as the basis for an article of women in the 1930s, 20s, and 30s in the county, because two of them were homesteaders. The last homestead in the county, see, they stopped homesteading in the middle 1930s because the federal government ended the homesteading program. And there were more women homesteaders than we realize, but the last homestead in the county was out almost by the Mountain Ute Reservation out there. If you know where Marvel and Klein are, if you go down that road past Hesperus, out past the old Fort Lewis, you hit Klein and Marvel and Breen, well, they were west and south of there, really smack up against the Southern Ute Reservation. And it's just a darn good series of interviews. I'm going to use Violet because she just is so interesting. And these other two, one as a teenager and one as a wife, homesteaded.
What other interviews stand out in your mind?
Some interviews with the Cub players, simply because that just was enjoyable to do. Some of the early ones, I interviewed two Cornish ladies. Cornish, the cousin Jacks and cousin Jennies, came over from Cornwall, England, and I interviewed two of them who had been born in Caribou, which is my first love. I did my master's thesis and later a book on it. Everyone remembers their first love. Well, this mining camp's my first love, which either says something about my warped youth or I don't know what. But anyway, just because they were so friendly and they gave me recipes, saffron, which if you go down the store, it's locked up. You know, it's worth so much. It's worth more than silver per ounce. And because really they pushed it back. That's as far back as I've ever been able to go. And obviously now we can't go back that far. I mean, that was the 1870s. Lord, that's only a few years after the Civil War. So, I mean, that's 120-some years ago now. But they were just great interviews because they were just darn nice people. And they were very kind and nice to me because I was not an experienced interviewer. And they just sort of, we all flowed along together. We learned together, and they were really nice. But, I can't think of any really memorable ones. One lady wanted to share her book of poetry with me one time, and I didn't want. She wrote poetry about like I write poetry, which isn't very well. And but she wanted me to read. She wanted to read it into my tape recorder, so I pushed the pause button. She never did know. That I know. But she gave me a book of poetry, so we didn't. It wasn't lost to eternity. I donated the book over the library. Right off the top of my head, there's too many. I've got them all the way back. I've got transcriptions of all of them. I'm sorry, Todd. I just off the top of my head, some of those are my memorable ones. They all didn't have to really. Some of the best ones. Sometimes you just pick up one or two little things from an interview. Sometimes interviews go along very dull. You never know what you're going to get. That's what makes it exciting. It's like something new every time. But you'll be going along thinking, oh, my goodness. You can't show them that you're bored, but you think this is really not good. I just hope to get more. All of a sudden, somebody, they'll just come up with something. Like one lady ran a hairdressing business downtown, and she had her salon, as she called it, right down next to the Chamber of Commerce, Prohibition days, and she said one day, they had transoms on top of doors in those days, glass doors, and she looked through the transom. She was working late at night. She just finished doing some lady's hair, and she heard all this laughing next door at the Chamber of Commerce, and the Chamber of Commerce members and some of the movers and shakers in Durango and the local police, this was in the 1920s, were drinking up the evidence from a prohibition trial. And that's just out of a clear blue sky. She just came up with that story, which this is the type of thing you'll get. I don't know when it happened in the 20s. But another one was Jackson Clark Sr. Jackson Clark Jr. runs Tualatin downtown. And Jackson Clark Sr.'s mother was one of my really memorable interviews. She was Harry Jackson's daughter, and Harry Jackson had come here in the 1880s, and she was talking about Prohibition again. And she apparently had been kind of a wild, daring woman, nothing wild about this, but she talked about going downtown, and they had a lot of Muller milk parlors. She said, said you went to the back, and you'd peer through, and you have to tell everybody what this was, and you can go in and get your bathtub gin. She said, but there were other ways. She said the milkmen painted bottles white, and they would bring by with your order of milk. At that day and time, the milkman came by, and you'd leave your milk out in front. None of you remember that, but they did. And you would get these little white bottles, bottles painted white, and you couldn't tell the difference between milk or whatever they were, not from the street anyway, but it wasn't. It was bathtub gin or whatever booze you were ordering. He said the other way to do it, the coal man would bring it by. It's a little bit more chancy there. And along with your ton of coal, almost anyone in town would have coal. They would wrap the booze into the burlap sack, and they would put it down not under your ton of coal, or you wouldn't have anything, but somewhere near the top. You have to be very careful, and you'd feel around, you'd get probably filthy, but there would be your booze. And one lady was talking too about, speaking of that, this is how you learn things, and this was a great area for stills. Silverton was, and Durango was, and she said her brother was an alcoholic. This is a real problem in the middle of Prohibition. And but she said that she and her husband just spent all morning painting the floor. Now, some of you have heard, kitchen floor, some of you have heard about bathtub gin and all these things. I mean, people went crazy drinking it. They went blind, killed people. I mean, it was deadly. Anyway, her brother knew where to get this, and he had a hip flask, and he didn't want to drink in front of his nieces and nephews, her children. So he came over just after they finished painting the kitchen. They were all sitting in the living room. And he went out the kitchen. The floor was dry, but he went out the kitchen to have a little guzzle. And then he left and went off on his business. And she and her husband went out in the kitchen, and where he'd spilled some of it and eaten right through the paint. Their brand new paint, this booze had eaten right through it. I mean, this is what you pick up. We're not going to pick this up anywhere else except in oral history.
Well, you've interviewed old people. What are the youngest people that you've interviewed?
English people. Oh. They were young when I interviewed about it. I've interviewed people. Oh, golly, I've interviewed people in their teens. When I was doing Durango history, I just didn't interview old-timers. I interviewed tourists. I interviewed younger people to get their attitudes about Durango. It all depends on what I'm trying to approach. If I'm doing work with caribou, then I automatically was locked into older people, and you're typically locked into older people because that's what you're doing. But no, I've interviewed people in their teens.
How is that different, getting an interview?
Well, you're looking only for one or two specific things because they don't have that breadth and depth of an interview.
Along the topic with young people, do you think this oral history is a good project in the high school setting?
I think it's an excellent. It's that kind of that Foxfire concept that they had in North and South Carolina. I think oral history, I think it's great. In fact, in our middle school, we're just finishing up. Some of you know that I'm not teaching this year. I'm on sabbatical, but I've been on sabbatical since May of last year. grand time. But one of the things we just finished up, it was a middle school history, Colorado history. And at the end of every chapter, the things that you can do, activities you can do. And we hammer at this oral history. Visit, talk to your grandparents. It gives kids roots. It gets them a sense of belonging to something. Let's face it, my daughter doesn't think anything happened really important before 1968. And you might think that's pretty far back in the days when you all remember when Caesar invaded England about that time. And it does give you, it lets them have a sense of something beyond, and they can find out that, hey, what I'm going through today, maybe it's a little bit different and maybe in some ways it's worse, but it's not really that much different than it was 40, 80, 100 years ago. For example, the first drug bust in Durango was in August of 1881. That's 113 years ago. And sure, we're all worried about nuclear bombs or atomic bombs or missiles. Well, they were worried about smallpox, and they were worried about TB, and they were worried about the common cold. Sure, we've got AIDS, but you couldn't cure syphilis and gonorrhea 100 years ago. You could cure the outward symptoms, but you couldn't cure it. Once you got it, you had it. Nellie and I talked about that. I just finished a history, medical history, medicine and mining camps, and social ills were one of the problems. And sure, we have gang fights today. But you realize in 1 month in Denver in 1919, they arrested 300 and some juveniles for crime? Everything from robbery to attempted murder to shoplifting. I'm not saying we should, nothing to worry about, gang. We've lived through all this before, so let's not get all that concerned. But I think it allows you, interview, especially for younger kids, it allows them to see that these things, it really isn't the first time that we've ever done this. Yeah?
Where did your passion for the history of Colorado come from? And how many books did you read
about Colorado? Solely about Colorado. It's a good question. I don't know. 17, 18? I really can't say. I've never really looked at it quite that way. Colorado's in almost all of them somewhere. I don't know where. I've always loved history. When I was a little kid, my dad was in the Navy. And one of the greatest things I ever did as far as a book, my dad was a Japanese prisoner in the Second World War. And in 1991, we published his memoirs, Prisoner of the Emperor. I was the editor. He lives here in town. And it came out just in time for Pearl Harbor. It was one of our better, not the Pearl Harbor, but the 50th anniversary of the Pearl Harbor. It was one of the more fun things I ever did because I went down memory lane because I was living in a little Illinois farming town. I didn't answer your question, but what I was driving at was this, that after the war, my dad was in the Navy, and we went back to Virginia. It was his first duty. And we were at, he was a naval dentist, Bethesda Naval Hospital, which the president gets an upset tummy if they go to Bethesda. Anyway, we toured Civil War battlefields, and I talked to people who, parents or grandparents had been involved in the Civil War. I mean, they were old folks, and they instilled something. I toured Bull Run Battlefield, for example, with Wade Hampton Morgan. He was the grandson of Wade Hampton, who had fought, general at Bull Run. And he was been there talking about General B, if you know, Civil War, and Stonewall Jackson, and they were all there. He was talking about it like you and I would sit down and talk about Jose Canseco. These were live people. I mean, he remembered my grandfather told my father, might even told him for all I know. This Wade Hampton Morgan had been in a prisoner of war camp with my dad. And I always loved history. It was one of the subjects I did better than I did well in it. In fact, if you look through my whole career, I did well in it. And I guess I just sort of had an interest toward history. And I love history. I love to make history come alive, any type of history. I started out in Indian and military history, but I very quickly got into mining history, and from there I went to social history. I've done medical history and political history, and you name it. I've touched on just a variety of things. And I have yet, sort of like Will Rogers, who never met Richard Nixon, but he said he never met a person he didn't like, but I've never really met a topic in history I don't like. Maybe the Venerable Bede and Tom McEnroe, but that's about the only thing.
Well, how has your love of history and your expertise in history affected the way you do oral history interview?
I think it's given me a depth I wouldn't have had otherwise. Too often, you got to know the territory. Okay, you got to know Durango, but yet you got to know what's going on outside of Durango. The New Deal legislation, you got to know what that is and how it impacted. How it impacts other places. Excuse me. When you're not really into lecturing or talking, it's funny how it's like any other skill. I usually can talk 3 or 4 hours in a row, but now I start to cough a bit. But I think it's made it for me a lot deeper, a lot richer, especially as I've I've gotten into so many different things. I never thought I would sit around, and, especially with a young lady present, talk about syphilis and gonorrhea. It doesn't even faze me today. And prostitution. I can remember I get in high school, and I live in this little Illinois town, which I'm, by the way, studying now. One of the projects I'm doing is I love the 1890s. That's a great era for the Cubs. But the 1890s is a good era, and I'm doing a study, a contrast comparison study of a farming town, a town I grew up in, San Antonio, Illinois, which has a lot of my relatives in it, and the one here, Durango. But I can remember in the 1950s, the teacher told me, I was giving an oral book report. It was on Cripple Creek. I'd read a book on Cripple Creek, which is typical. I'd Civil War or the West, what I usually read. And I started talking about prostitution. It was Cripple Creek days, which is Mabel Barbie Lee. She talked about this madam. And so I started to talk about this madam. And I got the attention of the whole class until I was told we could find some other topic to discuss in the book. We didn't have to discuss that one. And so I changed the topic. Not I didn't change your book, but I just changed the topic. But times have changed. But I really got off your top question there. But I think it's just one of those things. I think sometimes you have a bent toward this. I mean, why am I a Cub fan? That's in my genes. My father was a Cub fan before me. And I think a love of history, I just have always had it. Some people don't like history. Some people, unfortunately, have a bad teacher. I had bad teachers, but I overcame.
One last question is, how do you think your style of doing oral history interviewing has changed over these...
I think it's gotten much better. It's just like writing, you know. I would hate to go back, and I never read anything after it comes out. Never do. For a very good reason. After you spent all that time researching it and writing it, and your wife edits it, and you get, believe it or not, I think it's as near as a male can come to having a baby. And you just get so tired, and then you read a galley proofs, and you don't want to read it again. But if I did go back, I know that I could, I hope I could, I don't know, I hope I would write it better today. I hope I'm writing better today in many, many ways. And I would think my oral histories would be much better. I'm much more at ease. The first times, you know, you talk about being nervous, I was nervous. There's nothing, you don't have to feel bad about that. I don't think I'm not nervous today. There's nothing they can talk to me about that's going to throw me for a loop. Nothing. I think there's a depth in my interviews and a confidence in what I'm trying to get. And I get a lot of things I don't expect to get. But I think if I went back and interviewed the Todd sisters, that's those two ladies, Caribou, that I would do it differently. I'd have different approaches. I would know more about their life today than I knew in 1960, 61. I was just learning. But today I have a darn good idea what their life. I got to tell you one quick story. Can I tell you one more story?
Sure.
These two girls. They live in this nice little frame house at Caribou, which was still standing when I first went there. Caribou's up above Boulder. It's up above Nederland. Nederland was the mill town for Caribou, and that's where my mine is. I actually own a mine, which is being operated today. You're looking at Horace Tabor Newt Jr. here. But anyway, the Todd daughter. This was so great because I had two of them, and one of them would get the other one going. Now, you remember, I didn't even have to interview him. I just threw the question. I was like, here's the flip of the coin. Heads, tails, go. And then off they go. But they got talking one day. There were two things they could not do. They were not supposed to play with the kerosene lamps because fire was a real factor. And they weren't supposed to go in the basement. This house actually had a basement. And it was sort of a root cellar. Well, one day their mother, they lived sort of on one side of the saddle of Caribou, and the mother had to go over this little saddle and drop down to the talons over here. So they were playing house, and they had to have some cans. They had canned goods in those days. And so they went down in the basement, and they got some cans to play with. They weren't going to open them. They were just going to play with them, and they were going to put them back before Mommy got back. Well, they got so carried away playing house and all these things that suddenly they heard Mommy coming up the sidewalk with a path into the house. And so they had to do something. Well, they decided we got to hide this before Mommy sees us and we'll be punished. And they had living room, they had a big potbelly stove. And their dad was a teamster. That is, he freighted goods in Caribou. And He always, in the mornings, because the caribou is 10,000 feet in the evening. It's a chill. I was snowed up there one time on July 4th. It was 85 degrees in Boulders, 20 miles down the canyon, snowing at caribou. We went up there for a picnic, and then we ate the watermelon down at Boulder. We were teeth were chattering up there. But anyway, so they decided, quick, they open up the top of the potbelly stove and put the cans in. Well, then they went, Mom came home, and they got talking about what Mom had done, and they forgot completely that they'd put the cans in the stove. Well, that night, what they typically would do as a family would sit around like this, and they had board games to play, but this night they were reading. They liked to read. One of them would read. One of the daughters would read, or the father or the mother. And it was a little bit chilly, so Father went over and lit the potbelly stove, fire in the potbelly stove, and they were reading away. And all of a sudden, these cans exploded. They lifted off the top of the potbelly stove, knocked down the pipe. All the soot and ashes went all over the living room, and it was also the dining room. And didn't catch anything on fire. And Mother and Father couldn't imagine what had happened. But that was at that point that the daughters remembered where they'd put the cans, and the cans had exploded. And so that was one of their more embarrassing experiences in life.
Dwayne, you've done us a real favor by talking to us.
Oh, I don't know about that, but thank you very much. I had fun.
Thank you very much. Craig has a question.
Just a quick question. Yeah. For you, out of curiosity, as a mutual Cubs fan and anybody who beats the White Sox, have you got the chance to interview Harry Carey?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've interviewed Harry. Harry's a good interview. The only problem with Harry Carey, you've got to catch him –